This is Ready Radio, preparing you to be ready for anything. Now, here's your survival guide for Ready Radio, John Rush.
All right, it is Ready Radio, KLZ 560. Thanks for joining us today on this fine Friday, July the 26th. The year is rolling by. Lots to talk about today. And what I want to concentrate in the first part of today's program might seem a little bit off for this particular program, although I don't think it is. This show is Ready Radio, meaning I want you guys to be ready for anything. Anything that might come along in life. And by the way, that could be everything from just your day-to-day life to earth-shattering, world-changing events and everything in between. So I was reading some things even before the program today. I've got a few things to talk about, debunking some survival myths that I'll get to as well, time given. If not, by the way, we always take your calls. 303-477-5600, 303-477-5600. I'll get the text line brought up here as well. You can always text us as well, 307-200-8222, 307-200-8222. But prior to coming on air today, I just happened to be doing a little bit of research and some prep and so on, and you always check some of the social media sites and just kind of see what's going on. And one thing that caught my eye that I thought does have to do with preparedness, and I get this is probably as much as a drive radio conversation as it is for this, although to me this is more of the preparedness end of things. And it fits into several different categories, I guess you could say. But I saw a post today. I belong to some of the local neighborhood Facebook groups. And so there was one in one of the neighborhoods near me. And something to the tune of, can somebody recommend an oil change place for my expensive car that won't charge me an arm and a leg for synthetic oil? And again, this might be a drive radio topic, but I think it fits here as well, because my first thought was, okay, time out. First of all, you're driving an expensive car, and I did a little bit of research, and it happens to be an Infiniti. So this particular young lady is driving an Infiniti, and there's nothing against Infinitis. I have nothing against them. I test drove one the other day and even did a review on one, which I don't do reviews on this particular program, but if you want any car reviews, just go look at any of my other websites, Rush to Reason or Drive Radio websites, and you'll find our car reviews there. And I did a couple of Infinities here of late. I mean, I don't have anything against Infiniti at all. They're a more expensive car to own. Any of the more expensive brands are going to be more money to maintain. So that leads me into the conversation I wanted to at least start off with today, which is being prepared. And what I mean by that is being prepared in every aspect of your life. So I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus, by the way. I don't know this young lady from Adam. Honestly, wouldn't know her if I saw her walking down the street. But it caught my eye because I'm thinking, okay, somebody didn't help you in the forefront of you buying a vehicle and explaining, if you buy this vehicle, these are the things that you can expect when it comes to the service and maintenance of. Because I just for grins, and not that I was trolling, but I thought, well, I'll go look at this person's other posts just to see what else is here. And here's why I did that. I wanted to see, number one, what's their lifestyle like. And you can tell a lot about somebody's lifestyle by going to social media. And then I also wanted to see, is there anything else that they've asked about said car? And yes, there were. So let me get into what they're asking about on the car as well. So in this particular situation, she also wanted to know, not that long ago, where do I buy cheap tires for my expensive car? Again, we're asking, where do I buy inexpensive things for my expensive item that, second to my house or my rent, is the most expensive thing I own? And I didn't comment or respond because I just don't do those things. I rarely go on social media and post anything. Just not my gig. Not what I do. And I guess partially because I do it so much here, I don't need to. So in this case, I'm rolling through and I'm looking at, of course, all of the other things. And I don't know this person's financial situation at all. Have no idea how much money's in the bank, married, not married. I didn't go through all that. Don't care. My point was, it looks like their lifestyle is fair. Don't see anything super extravagant, but I also don't see them not doing social things. For example, if you can take the kid to Topgolf, because I've been to Topgolf, and I know it's not the cheapest thing in town to do entertainment-wise, but if you can go take your youngster out for Topgolf and movies, and we all know what movies cost, Andy Pate can tell you that straight up, and he'll be on here at Rush to Reason here in a few minutes, right after I'm off air today. If you guys listen to this program as a replay, yes, Rush to Reason, which comes up right after Ready Radio on Fridays, we spend all Fridays talking about all things movies. So if you get a chance to listen in, we have a lot of fun on Fridays, and it's a great time. And I can tell you right now, Andy will tell you first up how expensive going to the movies actually is. I'm thankful Andy does what he does, by the way. But they're not cheap. Going to the movies, in fact, Charlie, you went to one here of late. Movies aren't cheap, are they? They're rather expensive, especially if you get any kind of food or do anything there. It's nothing to spend singly, what, $40 or so? Am I too far off on that? Charlie says that's about right. $35, $40. By the time you buy your ticket, you buy a few things at the concession stand, you're $40 or so. So do that for a couple of kids and do the math. And my point is, I'm looking through this social media post of this particular individual thinking, okay, this is not a poor person. I don't know their financial status, and I'm all for saving money when you can save money. But when you're talking about the item that your life depends on, i.e. your car, because without it here in the West, it's really hard to do anything without one. And Charlie did it for years. Rode the bus, rode the train, and Charlie will tell you it was hard. It's a complete lifestyle change, right, Charlie? Yeah, and he even said it's hard on your body. It's not only hard on your time, your body, your scheduling around everything involving that public transportation, even getting groceries. You're planning everything around that end of things. And frankly, it's not for me. I mean, I commend Charlie for doing it as long as he did. I don't know how he did because he's a better man than me. There's no way I could have done that. It's impossible. So to me, owning a car, and that's partly why I talk about it on Ready Radio, it is the lifeblood of what we do. We in this particular part of the country cannot survive without one, in my opinion. It's extremely, extremely difficult. And have any quality of life, by the way. And I know some people might argue with me on that, but I think most of you listening would agree with me. So as I'm scrolling through and I'm thinking, okay, we've got a post about buying cheap tires and we've got a post about cheap oil, and it's evident that we don't want to spend money on our vehicle, yet we bought an Infiniti. And here's where I'm going with this. This is just one example of where I think a lot of people run into problems in their life because they didn't think far enough down the road with what they're purchasing. And that's where I dial this back into Ready Radio. I want people to be prepared. And the more prepared you are, of course, financially speaking, the more prepared you are for all of the other things that I talk about on this program week to week. You know, how do you stock up on this? How do you store that? How do you have extras of this or extras of that? Well, if you're scraping by, you know, paycheck to paycheck, you can't plan for anything else. You'll be lucky to help your own family out, nonetheless anyone else, when the crap hits the fan. And when will that happen? Folks, I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. By the way, no one does. There's lots, I'll get into this in a little bit here. There's lots of commentary right now about even the upcoming election. If somebody, you know, if depending upon who wins, what will happen? Will there be some civil unrest no matter who wins? And I'll talk about that in future shows as we get closer and closer to the election. Quite possibly. You know, last time around when Donald Trump won, look what BLM did. Look at the amount of cities that were burned down and the things that happened shortly thereafter. Could that happen again? Absolutely. I want you all to be prepared for those things just in case. But I go back to this particular post and what got me thinking about, are most people prepared financially speaking through the purchases they make to then be as ready as they possibly can? And I think in a lot of cases, the answer is no. In this particular case, in this particular post that I was reading through and all of the other posts associated with it, I will tell you that it's a no. Now, how did this person end up with an Infiniti? That I can't answer. I didn't scroll through all of the history to determine, was there a big celebration day where, you know, people post on social media the new car they bought? Was it new? Was it used? Was it handed down? I don't know. I don't know the situation. What I do know is most people buy cars. In fact, most people buy cars and then finance said car. Rarely does somebody go pay cash for a car. It happens. but not very often. You have to be fairly well-to-do to be able to go write a check for a car in today's world, because most cars are $50,000 to $60,000. That's the average price today of a new car. Yes, there's some cheaper. Yes, there's some much more money. It's an average. So when I say that, I'm always getting feedback of, well, I buy such and such, such and such for such and such. Well, of course you can. Average means there's X amount of cars bought above that, and there's X amount of cars bought below that. Although I will tell you, being a car person myself, it's really hard to buy a new car for much less than, you know, a decent used car, mid-40s. So that 55, you know, 50, 55 range that they're saying is the average sale of a new car, it's dead on. Because it's hard to buy a car much less than that. And the Infiniti, yeah, you can buy some Infinities in their 40s, but I can tell you the model that she was driving is higher priced than that. And once again, I don't know if this young lady bought it new or used. Doesn't matter. My point is, wrong car to own. Wrong car to own. That's a luxury car that only those, in my opinion, that are well-to-do should own. You know, upper-income people should own. And I'm not trying to judge those that would own it that are lower income. I'm just saying I feel you should have a higher income to own that car. She'd be much better off owning a Toyota Corolla or a Toyota Camry, for example, not an Infiniti QX50, which is what she owns. So this is where proper planning, proper readiness comes into play. So piece of advice on anything you're looking to buy. Doesn't matter what it is. Number one, do your research. What's my total cost of ownership going to be in this item? That could be a home. That could be a car. It could be anything. What's my total cost of ownership? Most other things anymore are fairly disposable. So, you know, you go buy a new TV. Well, the cost of ownership is what you paid for it, typically. There's not much you're doing maintenance-wise on your TV. But there's other things that you can buy where there will be some maintenance and or consumables that go with it that then drive up the price of said item. Printers, for example, for years and years, we have known, it's been well known in the industry, that they sell you a really cheap printer to capture you so they can sell you super expensive toners and ink. I mean, super expensive. They're making all of their money by almost giving you a printer but selling you super overpriced cartridges. And I'm, Charlie, that's been that model for years. Until of late, Epson just came out, by the way, not that long ago, a printer whereby consumables are actually fairly inexpensive. You pay a little bit more money for the printer on the front side, but your consumable cost is nil. So that's changing a little bit, but my point with cars especially is you really need to look at total cost of ownership. Just because you like the car and it's comfortable and it's a great deal or whatever the case may be, is that in the end your best deal? And you really have to fine tune that, and that's where folks like myself can even come into play. And to the credit of a lot of you listening, you will ask me. I had a question late last night. I'm looking at a Ford such and such. I've got these three choices to buy. What should I buy? And I rattled right back off. These are what I would buy and what I wouldn't buy. And by the way, the choices that were on the list, only one of them would I have chosen. The other two were no-goes. And I got a very nice thank you that really helps. And you know what I hope I'm doing in those situations is saving somebody a lot of money and grief on down the road. I really do, because some of these decisions that people could make and where the unknown when you go to a used car lot or a dealership and don't really know, just because the vehicle looks, feels, smells, sounds great, in the end, is that the proper purchase for you? And I will tell you, and I've said this on Drive Radio for years, most car purchases are not what somebody needs. Rarely is it what somebody needs. Most cars, especially, like homes, are bought on emotion, not facts. Oh, I really like that car. Oh, I'd like to be seen in that car. Oh, that's the color I want. Oh, that's the interior I want. That's the model I want. I've always wanted one of those. That's the brand I want. I'll only buy this. And some people get very short-sighted on what they should own because of what I just said a moment ago, and in a lot of cases end up financially troubled because they continue to buy the wrong item over and over and over again. Very few people buy cars unemotionally. Most are bought through emotions only. Homes are kind of the same way, by the way. Oh, I really love the view. I really love this, or I really love that. And by the way, if you can afford it, great, knock your socks off. Problem is, a lot can't. Car-wise, it really would behoove most people to sit down. I talk about this a lot on Drive Radio. Get a legal pad out. Write out what your actual needs are. What vehicles then fit those needs. Which ones have the, you know, priced accordingly. And then on top of that, further that along, which one of those, you know, total cost of ownership. And that's where you got to be a little careful on new cars, because they'll sort of be slimy about that and tell you that the cost of ownership is less than it actually is. And that's where folks like I come into play and tell you exactly what it costs to own that car. And we can tell you which ones are more money versus less. My whole point with this particular conversation to start things off today with is, with anything in life, you really need to weigh out the actual costs total of that decision so that, like this case, you're not going out publicly saying, hey, where do I go get a cheap whatever? And by the way, I don't know whether they can afford it or not. Maybe they're just cheapskates. I don't know. Maybe they're trying to be buy the cheapest thing they possibly can. I could get into all sorts of explanations on that car and the oil and what to use and the fact that she's not going to find anybody that does that correctly that will do it cheap, because that's not a car that you can do that on. If you do, you're going to have future problems. But that's a Drive Radio conversation. Which, for those of you maybe that don't hear that show, that's on Saturday from 10 to 1. We talk all about cars. I've done that show for a long time, 2 decades plus. And we answer those types of questions on a regular basis. And again, I hope we save people money in a lot of cases when it comes to those things like I just mentioned a moment ago, by helping people not make the wrong choice. So I want to start off today by just saying the best way to be ready for the what-ifs of life is to be financially positioned where you can take advantage of things that come along at times to better yourself in those areas, so that when, or if, probably when, times get really tough and there's some sort of a world-changing event, you're more ready for that particular event than your neighbor or your cohort would be. And I will tell you from the posts I read in this particular situation, this person is not. This person will be one of those that will be reaching out to everybody around them trying to figure out, how do I have fresh water? How do I have some extra food? How do I feed my kids? How do I get from A to B if my car doesn't run? I mean, I'm sorry to say, but that's why that statistic of X amount of people, government says about 30% of people die if power went out nationwide, coast to coast, and it lasted for a length of time, within 90 days, 30% of the population is dead. I think that's a low number, by the way. Problem is, there's far too many of the individual I'm mentioning today, and I'm not picking on this person. I didn't mention any names, of course, and I'm not trying to pick on this person. It's just an example of what you guys will see over and over and over again, even inside of your own families sometimes. And there's wiser choices you can make to keep you out of those circumstances. And that's my point here on Ready Radio. So lots of information, by the way, on our website, ready-radio.com. You can go there and find out all sorts of things. I'm going to debunk some survival myths here in a moment. As soon as we come back, if you'd like to chime in and add some things to what I just said, lines are open, 303-477-5600. We'll be right back. Ready Radio, KLZ 560. We are back. Ready Radio, KLZ 560. Thanks for joining us today. And if you'd like to be a part of our program and sponsorship-wise and so on, I don't say that enough either. Please reach out. Be happy to have you be a part of what we do. We reach all sorts of different clientele. And as you can tell, the list of sponsors we have is vast and always looking for more. So if that's something you're interested in, please reach out to me. You can do that through the website, ready-radio.com. All right. Survival myths that we're going to debunk. The first one of these, and I started this a few weeks ago, didn't get a chance to get very far in it, so I sort of tabled it until today. The first one was water. I'm not going to spend much time on that one because we already did it, but water rationing. It's really hard to ration water. We all know why. You need water. It's a part of your daily survival, and it's really hard to ration. Now, you cannot bathe and do things like that, although our hygiene has a lot to do with how healthy you are, even in an end-of-the-world type scenario as well. All of the different, you know, audiobooks and things that I listen to on an ongoing basis, that becomes a really big deal in the aftermath of any kind of a world-changing event. And I don't think most people give that enough credit, unless you've been to some of the third-world countries and traveled in areas where they don't have, you know, the modern type of hygiene that we have. I know some of you would think, well, what do you mean by that? Guys, I've been to places where they may have one change of clothing in another Sunday best. That's it. I'm not exaggerating. Raw sewage runs down the streets. There's no modern type plumbing. There's no faucets in the house. They use a community well to go fill a bucket up with every morning, maybe even in the evenings. That's how they would handle their day-to-day things. I mean, we take for granted, you turn the faucet and water comes out. You go to the toilet, flush it, and there we be. I mean, we really do take that for granted in this country. Clean streets. They're not all perfectly clean, but trust me, even the dirtiest of ours don't compare to what some third world countries look like. So we take that for granted. And because we're not used to not having hygiene, you know, problems like that, if we were to not have that, it would be detrimental, illness-wise. And I don't think folks really understand how crucial that is. But anyways, water, yes, we can ration it as far as, you know, bathing and washing of dishes and so on. But you got to be careful with even some of that, and I talked about that a few weeks ago. Food. Food's a big deal. You can survive 3 or 4 weeks without food. No, you can't. No, you can't. People say you can. The adage, a person can survive 3 weeks without food, is commonly cited. It's a commonly cited survival myth that oversimplifies the complexities of human resilience and physical exertion. Keep in mind, and this is my conversation, not the notes here, but in an end-of-the-world scenario where you're now working, physically exerting, walking, and doing things that you wouldn't be doing now, you actually are going to need a higher calorie intake than you have now. Yes, a lot of us have some pounds we could take off, and I get that, but that goes away pretty fast. And even with that happening, and your body essentially, you know, eating itself, if you would, using its own, you know, calories that have been stored, the fat, that's what it's doing, that's what your body does. Even with that, you still need some added nutrients to keep your head about you mentally and so on, so you're still going to need food. So physical exertion significantly changes that scenario as to, you know, you can survive 3 weeks without food. Most people couldn't go 3 days without food. Nonetheless, 3 weeks. Some can't go 3 hours. And I'm not exaggerating. I'm really not. Some literally eat that much. To go 3 days or 3 weeks, it wouldn't happen. So that's a big myth. So my point is, you're going to be either using food you've stored or having to find and supplement what you have in this type of a scenario, some sort of an end-of-the-world scenario. The next one is shelter and fire starting myths. Selecting an appropriate shelter in survival scenarios is paramount for safeguarding against harsh weather conditions and preserving your core body temperature. While the construction of lean-tos is frequently depicted in survival media as straightforward and efficient, the reality is that their effectiveness can significantly vary across different environmental settings. Yeah, as somebody that used to spend a lot of time out in the woods, don't do that so much anymore, but I did at one time, especially when I was younger. My dad was a real outdoorsman. We spent a lot of time outside hunting, fishing, doing all sorts of things. Yeah, lean-tos suck. Plain and simple. I mean, if you had to get by with one, you could, although most wouldn't even know the direction to place a lean-to. Some would say, well, what do you mean by that? Well, first of all, you wouldn't want the opening into the wind. You want your back to the wind. How many people, I mean, I go back to what I opened up this program with today, talking about somebody wanting a cheap oil change for an exotic car, or, you know, for an expensive car. Do you think that person's going to know how to build a lean-to? And the direction to build it? No, absolutely not. So critical to consider a myriad of factors, including the prevailing wind direction, as I just said a moment ago, the availability and type of insulation materials, what do you got to build it with, the level of ground moisture to construct your shelter on, and what kind of thermal protection do you have underneath or on top. And again, there's lots of factors here. And it's funny, when I watch shows like, and I guess it's just me, you watch Alive or Naked and Afraid, Naked and Afraid especially. I'm amazed. These are people that go on these shows, Naked and Afraid especially. They've got some sort of survival skills. They talk about their, is it PSA rating, Charlie? I think they talk about when they first start the show, their survival skills. They give them a particular rating, and then when they're done, they re-rate it based upon how well they performed on the show. These are people that typically come out of the outdoor arena. And what I mean by that is they're either guides or they're survivalists or they teach survival type things or they run survivalist camps and things like that. These are people that apply for the show that typically go on Naked and Afraid. And yet, I'm always yelling at the TV. The minute these guys get dropped off, I'm like, okay, first two things. Fire shelter. Fire shelter. Fire first, by the way. Shelter second. Fire, why? Well, because you can't make clean water that you can drink. Because, again, I go back to the hygiene we all have and the fact that our bodies aren't used to drinking water that wouldn't be clean. So if you're drinking anything that's contaminated, well, you're going to have the trots. And you see that on these programs. And I can't think of anything more uncomfortable than being naked on a show and having diarrhea. Not trying to be gross, but why would you want to do that? But they do. And why? Because they don't have the way to purify water, so then they get really dehydrated, because a lot of times they drop you off in these places where it's, you know, boiling hot, 100 degrees during the day, and you're depleted of all of your water, you're dehydrated, so now they'll just drink anything. And then they get a bug. And now they have a real problem, because not only are you dehydrated to begin with, but then when you have those sorts of vomiting and diarrhea problems, you're now even more dehydrated. It just compounds the problem. It just makes it that much worse. So I'm always, when they're there, I'm like, okay, because they're always chatting with each other. You know, like, you know, what do we do? And I'm thinking, okay, dummies, fire, shelter. How's this so hard? Figure out where you're going to at least set up camp for the night. Get your fire going. Worry about your shelter second, food and water last. You can go a day, in the case of them getting dropped off, you could go a day without water and food for several days even in their case, but you could definitely go without water for the first 24 hours. And if you've got a fire built, you can go get water and figure out a way to get it heated up and sanitized and so on. But I'm amazed at how many of them don't do that. Some of them, it might be 3 days before they fire, you know, they finally get a fire lit. And I'm thinking, you people are doomed. You're not going to make it. And you're supposed to be survivalists. So when it comes to starting fire, this is back to our article, the notion that any dry piece of wood is suitable for generating fire through friction is a misconception. Yeah, that's the other thing I've always said. I'm not rubbing two sticks together. You know, the early days of fire and, you know, who and where did fire come from? When was it invented? I have my own theories on that. Most of you know my background and how I view Earth. I'm a young earther. I'm not an old earther. And I just think it's something God instilled in men from day one. When the fall of man happened, fire started, end of discussion. That's my thought. God, he told him, here you go. Here's how this works. So personally, I don't think it was like two cavemen rubbing two sticks together and voila, fire started. No, I don't see it that way. To me, that sounds about as stupid as you could ever think. Point being, though, starting a fire, not as easy as most people think. So one of the things that you should always have on you is that ability to make fire. Do you have a lighter? Do you have a magnifying glass? What do you have that, you know, do you have matches? What enables you to start a fire immediately? I happen to, and this is going to sound really weird to some of you, in my pack, in my briefcase that I carry around daily, that has all my computer garb and everything in it, I got this thing off of the internet. It's this cheap little thing, and I can send you guys links to it. It's probably one of the cheesiest things I think I've ever bought. I didn't pay more than $10 for it. But in it, it's a rechargeable, battery operated. It's got flashlight, a few little tools, knife, all kinds of little gizmos in it. But one thing it has in it is the ability to take a piece of tissue, cotton, steel wool, whatever you can find. And in the middle of it, you push a button and it's like an old cigarette lighter. It literally heats up this middle electrode through the battery that it's powered with super red hot, where it will literally take a, you know, I always have like a piece of notebook paper with me because I carry a notebook all the time. You literally could tear a notebook page out, take a corner of it, you know, twist it up, take a corner of it, lay, and I've tried it. I've actually tested this. Turn this little device that I have on and you have fire. So in my case, with that little device with me, I've got the ability to make fire at any point in time. And it sounds simplistic, and it is, but I'm not rubbing two sticks together. Folks, those days are gone for me. We've gone so far beyond that that I'm not doing that. And I, yes, because of my background with my father and so on, I know how to start a fire. Not just the piece of paper I noted a moment ago, but once you have that, how do you build everything else around it to where you've got air being supplied and you're building the right kind of fire and it can get started and so on? I've done that many, many times over. And it, by the way, it's not as easy as the movies make it look. In every movie, oh, go start us a fire. Well, a few minutes later, the thing's roaring. Oh, that's not how it works. Any of you listening that have been out in the woods and have tried to start a fire naturally with whatever tools you have around you, it's not that easy, especially when things are wet. Yeah, I know there's pine needles and leaves. Yeah, there's all sorts of things. But again, when it's wet, that makes it really, really difficult. So I would highly suggest, especially for our young people, that you actually show them how this works. How would they create fire? If they didn't have that ability, you know, naturally, if they didn't carry around a lighter, matches, whatever, but even then, how do you get a fire going once you have that? You'd be surprised how many people lack that basic skill, and I'm not exaggerating. I go back to what I opened up with. This particular individual asking for a cheap oil change, I highly, highly, highly doubt she could go start a fire on her own. If she can't turn a knob somewhere, it ain't happening. And she's not alone. There are millions of her, and I'm not exaggerating, millions of her out there that would have no idea if they didn't have a torch or some modern way of starting a fire. And even then, could they actually start a fire, not just light the, you know, ignite the lighter, but could they actually build a fire? Highly doubtful. Highly doubtful. So again, one of those things where if some of you have young kids, I would highly suggest that you have that conversation and figure out a way, even if it's, you know, at your own house, out on the deck, and you go buy a little fire pit to practice with, you have them show you, here's how I would start a fire. How would that be done? And not with a fire log. I'm not lighting one end of a fire log. And by the way, there's lots of things you can buy now that will help you in these areas. I've even tested some of them and done some demos and different things throughout the years on all the different programs I've got. There's even little fire brick things now with a string where you literally lay that in the middle of a bunch of kindling and pull the string and it ignites and off you go. It's called a little fire brick. So there's all sorts of things along those lines that help. But my point is, I would highly suggest you and your family get together, and you all know this is how we would make this work. Here's how we would actually start a fire. All right, I will be right back. Don't go anywhere, folks. Again, a lot of the things I talk about, they're available on our website, ready-radio.com. You can go there, check out those things. We're continually adding things to it. Producer Ann does a great job of that. So with that, we'll be right back. Ready Radio, KLZ 560. All right, we are back. Rush to Reason, Denver's Afternoon Rush, KLZ 560. Several of you, by the way, thank you. Asked, hey, where do I find this pulse start, you know, fire starter thing you were talking about? We'll put a link up on the website, ready-radio.com. I sent both of you that asked, actually three people asked, I sent the links directly. But for all of you listening, we'll have a link up on the website here shortly. I sent that to producer Ann a moment ago. I tested that product, by the way, before COVID. So 5 years ago or so now. It seems like yesterday, but 4 or 5 years ago, I tested that product. It's great. They work fabulous. And they've just gotten better as time goes by, and it's literally called pull start. That's literally it. So pull start, fire, pull string, fire starter. So it's lay the thing in the middle of some kindling, and you set the string a ways away, and you literally just pull it and it starts to fire and off you go. So anyways, we'll put that up in our website, ready-radio.com. But yeah, starting a fire, big deal. Make sure that you've got the ability to do that. These things, really, as far as your bug out bag, which I hope all of you have, and whether or not you know you have a little one, a big one, keep in mind, you're going to carry it. Something I don't talk a lot about, but one of the things I've been experiencing in all of these audiobooks that I read is just how little you're able to carry with you. Think about that. If you're going to be walking several miles in a day, what are you carrying? Not much. And we could do a whole show, and maybe I will here in the recent or in the coming weeks on even firearms. What are you going to carry? Not as much as you think. A lot of people have a lot of different weapons and things like that. And the reality is, when it's all said and done, what's the easiest, lightest, most compact thing that you've got to carry and bring with you, knowing you may be walking 10, 15 miles a day or more? In some cases, more. So, something to think about. I probably, again, that's a show. I haven't done a gun show in quite some time. Probably should do that. I may very well put some things together this next week or the week after as we head down the stretch here, election-wise. Not a bad topic. Not that I feel like we're going to be needing those, but I'm one, again, this show is about being prepared at all times, no matter what happens. So, as we get a little closer, I'll start doing some research on that, and that's an easy one for me because it's sort of a natural thing. At least it is for me. I know it isn't for a lot of folks, but I've owned guns since I was very, very young. And I know that scares a lot of lefties, but my dad was a big outdoorsman. And back then, there weren't the hoops to jump through to own weapons like there is today. I think I got my first rimfire 22 when I was probably 10, I want to say. And I know for some people that really freaks them out. 10. I mean, I had a paper out when I was 9. So, I mean, I had enough responsibility to have a paper out and go around and collect money from people. I had enough responsibility to do that, and I did that on my own. Well, I also knew how to shoot, and I didn't carry going door to door because it wasn't necessary. But I've owned guns for that amount of time because my dad gave me my first one when I was very young. Now, for everybody, before you freak out, all you lefties, my dad kept it. It was, you know, kept under lock and key and all of that, and I didn't have full access to it, but it was mine, and I still have it. One of those sort of those things that you keep because it's very much a memory, and I'll have it probably until I die, pass it down to my kids. So the other thing, myth, eating raw meat and the pathogen risk. Consuming raw meat and seafood for survival poses significant health risks due to potential bacterial contamination and parasite transmission. Yeah, that one's kind of a given. I don't know anybody that would, you know, eat and consume raw meat, even raw fish. Even if you caught it out of a stream and wanted to eat it raw, I don't think I would. That's where the fire we just talked about a moment ago becomes a necessity because, you're going to want to cook whatever it is you catch. Rabbit, squirrel, you name it. And again, these survival books that I listen to, man, people eat all sorts of stuff. Things that we right now would think, I'm not eating that. Well, when you're desperate and there's nothing else, you will. And in a lot of these books I read, it's everything from, you know, raccoons, possum, porcupine, squirrel, rabbit. I mean, if it moves and it's edible, they're eating it. Skunk, even. I mean, they're eating it. And again, these are fiction books, and how real is it? Well, when you're desperate and you have nothing else to eat, I think you pretty much eat anything that moves. That's my own thought. Fish as well. I mean, they fish and do things along those lines as well. But eating raw meat, yeah, that one, I don't know anybody that would recommend that. And doing that, maybe beef, if you had, you know, really lean beef and you had to, possibly, but even then I'd be really nervous about doing that. I wouldn't, again, fire, cook, all of that, yes. Moss only grows on the north sides of trees. Scientific studies have effectively challenged a long-standing myth that moss exclusively grows on the north sides of trees, a misconception once commonly recommended for wilderness navigation. As revealed through ecological and botanical research, the reality is that moth's growth is not strictly limited to the north sides of trees, but instead influenced by a complex interplay of environmental factors. These include moisture availability, the intensity and duration of sunlight exposure, and the surface texture on which the moss grows. Now, I also will tell you that in different parts of the country or the world, there's different factors. Here in Colorado, I've seen moss for the most part on the north sides of trees, although there's times where you'll see it grow on other sides where it's like, well, wait a minute, I thought moss was only on the north side. In some cases, it's like a ring. It's all around it. Goes back to what we're talking about here. So not always a true indication that it's on the north side. And I've seen that personally in hiking and doing some of the things here in Colorado that I've done. That is not always the case. That's where having a compass, a good old-fashioned manual compass, again, that little device that I was explaining, that has a cheesy one built in. So the little fire starter thing that I talk about, there's one built in. I think that one I've got, I'll have to yank it out. Maybe I'll describe it a little more the next show we do. I think it's even got a seatbelt cutter, Charlie, with it, where if you're in a trapped or whatever and you got to get out, I think it's got a knife kind of a thing where it'll even cut the seatbelt if you had to. It works really well. It's got the little hook thing on it, and you just cut your seatbelt with it that way as well. All right, next myth, wound cleaning. The belief in the superiority of alcohol or hydrogen peroxide for wound disinfection is widespread survival myth that is debunked by scientific and medical research. Studies have shown that for most minor injuries, simply using clean water for wound cleaning is effective at minimizing infection risk. So in some cases, I think when we were young kids, Charlie, in fact, I can remember you'd get some sort of something banged up. And your mom would go in and they'd get the ivory soap or whatever and just clean your wound out and it hurt like no tomorrow. That in and of itself was probably enough. Probably didn't need to do anything other than that. And I've read all sorts of studies that a lot of the antibacterial cream isn't. It claims to be, but it's really not. In fact, in a lot of cases, it's not doing anything to help you with the wound. You'd be better off doing exactly what this article talks about, just getting it all washed out, getting it bandaged, and calling it good. Putting any kind of an antiseptic, there's all sorts of studies on that it really doesn't do much. Now, you do you. And if you feel like it helps, great. But there's a lot of, I think, myths even around that whole industry. And they've created all sorts of money, generate all sorts of money off of quote-unquote antibacterial cream and soap and so on and so forth. This article is really talking about how just caring for the wound, keeping it clean. If you've got some alcohol or peroxide, I'm not against that. I don't think this article is either. But in some cases, it's not actually helping. It might be hurting. In fact, this article goes to say, depending upon the wound, that hydrogen peroxide or alcohol might actually impede the healing process. So medical advocates advocate for a gentler approach to wound care. According to guidelines from healthcare authorities, clean running water, mild soap, as I said a moment ago, are recommended to clean cuts and abrasions. This method helps remove debris and bacteria without the adverse effects of more caustic cleaning agents, i.e. alcohol and so on. Further research supports that maintaining a moist wound environment rather than using drying agents like alcohol promotes faster and more efficient healing. That's where, by the way, the antibacterial things come into play. They're helping more just because they're keeping things moist, not because they've got any kind of a healing agent in them. Moisture helps migrate epithelial cells and reduce the risk of scab formation, slowing down the healing process. So you got to keep it dry. Additionally, evidence from wound care studies indicate that applying a sterile dressing after gentle cleaning provides a protective barrier that aids in maintaining optimal conditions for healing. So even I've learned through the years, even a little bit of you're going to use any kind of salve or something on it, less is better than more. Back to this article, sometimes too much keeps it too moist and doesn't help aid in the healing process. You're better off keeping it drier and letting it scab over and do its thing. The scab is a good thing, by the way, because once it scabs over, that's where the healing really begins, as we all know. You want it to scab up as quickly as you possibly can. So in conclusion, clean water, gentle cleaning practices, let it dry. And, of course, if it's bloody or bleeding, of course, you've got to stop that, of course. But outside of that, you want to just keep it clean and dry. Spinal cord injury movements. This is another myth. Detailing the importance of proper movement in suspected spinal cord injury cases is crucial to prevent further damage to affected individuals. Common myths associated with spinal cord injuries, such as the belief that moving a person with a suspected injury can worsen their conditions, have been debunked through medical research. In reality, proper stabilization and movement techniques can prevent complications and can improve outcome for individuals with spinal cord injuries. One specific example of a debunked myth related to spinal cord injuries is the misconception that immobilizing the entire body of a person with a suspected injury is necessary. Research suggests that immobilizing only the head and neck while allowed controlled movement of the rest of the body can be more beneficial in certain situations. I'm not a medical professional. That's something that I know nothing about. What I do know is this. The car is on fire. The person in it might have injuries, even spinal cord injuries. Are you better off leaving them in the burning car or extracting them? I already know the answer to that. Common sense says I'm getting them out of the burning vehicle. It doesn't matter if something else gets damaged along the way, because if you don't remove them, they're dying anyways. I mean, does that make sense? I hope that's pretty straightforward for a lot of people. You don't need a doctor or a medical advisor to tell you what to do in that particular scenario. Now, somebody has a great fall and nothing needs to be moved and you're waiting for medical care to show up, great. But if you're by yourself, what are you doing? Stabilizing that the best you can, and you still got to move. We're talking end of the world scenarios now. Those things may happen and you might be the only doctor around. That's where having a little bit of first aid wouldn't hurt all of us. A snake bite treatment. I've talked a little bit about this in the past, and yeah, the common myth is you're going to cut it and suck it and so on. No, none of that makes any difference. The biggest thing is to isolate that area, tourniquet, keep it from flowing into the rest of your body. That's what you want to do in those particular situations. You don't suck and do all the nonsense that we read. And again, best thing there is just to make sure that you've got the right protective gear in the first place so you don't have those problems occurring. And we in Colorado, we have rattlesnakes and things like that. Other parts of the country, there's different types of venomous snakes that are out there. And yeah, those are things, again, we're talking end of the world. What could happen? All sorts of things. And again, at the end of the day, these things will compound. You'll have more of them, more reptiles, more rodents, more everything, because they'll populate, because right now we control those. In an end of the world scenario, they're not being controlled anymore. You'll have a lot more of them than you have right now. Plus, I talked about this several weeks ago, mosquitoes, flies, those sorts of things you'll have much more of in that particular scenario. All right, guys, that's it for today. Ready-radio.com is our website. I encourage you to go there. We'll put up that pull start brick. I'll put that up there as well. Producer Ann will here shortly. And anything else you need, you're always welcome to send us a message at ready-radio.com. This is KLZ 560.
And opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker, commentators, hosts, their guests, and callers. They are not necessarily the views and opinions of Crawford Broadcasting or KLZ Management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.